Welcome to the show. I'm Jordan Harbinger. As always, I'm here with my producer, Jason DeFilippo. A long time ago, I answered my phone from an unknown number, which is something I never do. And I was exasperated. Whoever it was had called three times. I didn't have anything on my calendar. So finally, I answered in the most exasperated way I could muster at the time. I said, "This is Jordan. What's up?" And I hear, "This is General Stan McChrystal. Is now still a good time?" So after I swallowed my entire aorta, I ran to a quiet place and started brainstorming ideas with the general for an interview. And I quickly realized that General McChrystal and I were going to have an amazing conversation with a lot of rich takeaways here for you. And so today, the general and I discuss the elements of what makes a good leader, and more importantly, the myths about what many of us think makes a good leader, but might not actually be relevant at all, and how we can learn to examine and deconstruct those leaders we admire in a more effective way so that we can take on their characteristics for ourselves. We'll also learn how to stay focused when under fire, whether that's in the literal sense or more likely when we've got pressure from other parties to take a certain course of action when we really want to do something else entirely. And General McChrystal was really forthcoming and open in this interview, and I really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope you will as well. And I know a lot of you ask me, how do you get these guests? The answer is through my network, and the way that I create and maintain my network is through systems and tiny habits. And I want to teach you those systems and tiny habits for free. So check out our level one course over at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And don't forget, we've got worksheets for this episode. You can make sure you understand everything that was maybe the importantest stuff from General McChrystal. That's always in the show notes at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. All right, here's General Stanley McChrystal. Yeah, the books that I've read from you are really well-researched. It's not just like, hey, I was a general, I know all this stuff. There's a lot of stories, there's a lot of history, especially in Leaders, Myth and Reality, the newest one. And it's an intimidating read, man. I got this book, General, and I thought, this is like a 23-hour long audiobook. It's a big tome. There's a lot in there.
That's exactly right. And it was intentionally that. I mean, we don't want it to be intimidating, but we want it to have real content. What we didn't want to write was one of these superficial things. Here's what we think. We actually wanted to do the research in a thoughtful way.
I thought it was interesting. It's loaded with historical examples of leaders. I thought it was really an unusual choice, or maybe interesting for some other way, that you chose General Lee as one of the first examples. Talk about picking a controversial figure and then just throwing that out in front.
We wanted to do a Plutarch-based study of leadership, go back to sort of first principles, because we realized we really didn't think we understood leadership like we thought we did. And so as we try to assemble a number of people that we would profile, we figured out who should we do. And at one point we said, well, we should have genres. And we determined that power brokers would be one, and geniuses would be one, and heroes would be one. And in heroes, I had grown up with Robert E. Lee as one of my heroes. I'd gone to Washington and Lee High School. I'd grown up near his boyhood home. I'd gone to the same college as he had, West Point. I'd followed a career in the military as he had, in many parallels, except obviously he did better at all those things than I did. So he'd been a hero of mine. And I realized that I could write a book about leadership, but if I didn't include Robert E. Lee because he has become controversial, it'd be a cop-out, because I'd essentially be denying the fact that for much of my life, I wanted to be as much like Robert E. Lee as I could. In fact, for 40 years, I had a picture in my office or in different places in our military quarters that my wife had given me. And it was a painting, or it was meant to look like a painting. It was actually an inexpensive print that they'd painted over with clear acrylic to look like a painting. And I was very proud of this framed painting in my quarters for many years, because it represented to anybody who saw it and reminded me that this is what leadership should look like. And this is who I ought to try to be like. And so for 40 years, I really followed that. And then as we got in the last couple of years, and you saw Charlottesville and people starting to raise questions, my wife told me, she says, you should get rid of that picture. And I said, well, I can't, because you gave it to me and I love it. And Robert E. Lee's a hero of mine. And she says, I don't think it means to other people what it does to you. I think it symbolizes to other people something that you don't believe in. And that is things about white supremacy and whatnot. And I said, no, he's just a general. She said, no, he's a symbol. And you got to be careful about what unintentional message you send. So we went back and forth for about a month. And then I did more study and I thought long and hard about it. And I came to the conclusion she was absolutely right. And so at age 63, after having this picture for 40 years, I took it off my wall and threw it in the trash.
Oh, wow. It didn't even make it to the garage. Straight to the trash?
Straight to the trash. And at the same time, we were starting to write this book. And I said, but still, I can't duck studying and writing about Robert E. Lee. So as we studied it more, it gave me the chance to really think more deeply about what Robert E. Lee represents. Because at West Point, he represented leadership and excellence and loyalty. But as you think it further, here's a guy who was an extraordinarily talented leader. But then at the crucial moment of his life, he makes the decision to betray his country, to try to destroy that country, and do it in defense of slavery, the biggest evil in American history. And no matter how you try to say, no, he was just loyal. No, he made a decision that can't be cleaned up, you know, through any lens of history. And so in reality, I don't think he was an evil person, but I think he made an extraordinarily bad decision. And I think that's a cautionary tale for all of us, not only for what we should do in our lives, but also for how we should view leaders.
When we profile modern leaders, it's hard to not profile somebody who's got a couple of skeletons in the closet. I'm not trying to compare Robert E. Lee with Steve Jobs, for example. I think there's a lot of differences there. But when you look at guys like Steve Jobs, when you look at leaders like Steve Jobs, you see that these guys are really proud of the teams they've created. They're really hard on everybody, though. They're, to a fault, a terrible person to work with. Where do you think the line is? Or does it not matter? I mean, do you care what your subordinates, for example, think about you personally? Or does that have no place in leadership?
I think it does, Jordan. In one point in the book, I relate that when I was a young officer, I was taught that in combat, if something is stupid, but it works, it isn't stupid. And if you apply that to leadership, you say, well, if something is bad leadership, abusing your people or being dishonest, but it works, is it bad? And the question the answer I come to is, yes, to a degree it is. There are things in leadership that work that make something effective, and they may be effective for the long term. More often, they're effective for the short term only, and they're just not good leadership. But the reality is, history is replete with them. In the book, we study two founders. Since you talk about Steve Jobs, we study Walt Disney and Coco Chanel. And this won't surprise you. I didn't know much about Coco Chanel before we wrote this book.
Yeah, I was going to say, that must have been a new one for you.
I'm now an encyclopedia of knowledge if you have questions. But the interesting part is these were founders who created something from whole cloth. They created companies. They created empires. They created brands. But they were not easy people to work for. And we could say that they were effective because they were demanding and they were detail-oriented and they were almost fanatical in the pursuit of the mission to create something. But their creation typically ranked higher in their priorities than their people did. And when they had to make a judgment between the two, they would often go to the mission over the people. But interestingly, they never had problem attracting talent, because even though it could be a brutal environment to work for either of them, it was also a place of great creativity in each case. It was a place of success and respect from the outside. So it makes us think about what we as followers actually want. Sometimes we want leaders who are particularly caring and nice to us, but at other times we're willing to give up some of that, because we want to be part of something that's being created that we judge to be special.
It seems like we're kind of trying to figure out, if we're a leader, do we put our vision first or our people first? And do you think there's a right answer to that question? Because I feel like there's a lot of leaders that now talk about putting people first. If you look at companies like Zappos, for example, that's all about people first, customers and employees and team members. But then you've got these visionary types going back to guys like Steve Jobs or Coco Chanel, where you think, okay, this is a person who treated people probably pretty poorly. And one of the reasons for that was the product, the experience, the brand mattered so much that people always took a back seat. But even then, they didn't have trouble attracting that talent because their vision was so strong.
Well, that's right. And I've thought a lot about this, and I think most of us as leaders do. And I think it's a balance. I don't think there's a single right answer that says, I only care about the mission, I only care about people. And even though there are many leaders now who say, the only thing I focus on is my people, that's not actually true. I mean, they have to worry about being profitable. They have to worry about serving their stockholders, and they have to worry about their clients. And so to simplify it and say that it's just about taking care of people is I've never seen it be actually fully correct. At the same time, I do think many thoughtful leaders understand that the most valuable resource that they have are their people. The thing that actually creates the most valuable value, the thing that actually gives them the most opportunity to accomplish the mission, is through the people. This is, of course, you know, best or well exemplified in the military, where a leader has got to try to build a force, but then put that force in harm's way, literally risk having it destroyed to do the mission and to lose people. And so it becomes very black and white. And the best leaders I've seen understand the inherent paradox in that dynamic, and they balance it, and they approach each case with an understanding that you've got to be somewhat flexible, somewhat organic in this.
I see that when you started to write the book, and I saw this in the introduction or maybe the preface of the book, that you weren't able to keep a journal of your day-to-day activities as a general, because classified info in a book somewhere, probably not a good idea. And you kind of had to reverse engineer your experience when you were going to write about leadership. And in doing so, discovered that a lot of what you'd known about being a leader perhaps wasn't exactly as you'd previously thought.
Yeah, this was very humbling. You don't keep diaries in the military. It was sort of from my earliest days, you were told that if you kept a diary in combat and you were killed and the enemy captured it, they would get intelligence. And nowadays, it's also about classified information. So I never did any of that. And so as a consequence, you're down to your memory. So when we went to write my memoirs starting in 2010, I said, well, we're going to write my memoirs. This can't be hard, because I was always there. I was the star of the show. And yet we laid out this big, long timeline. This young assistant and I laid out this timeline of my life. And then we started finding people to go interview who'd been involved in things. And when we pulled all this together, more than 100 interviews, it was kind of shocking. What I had remembered about events, sometimes it was absolutely just inaccurate, wrong. But every time it was incomplete. And so what would happen is I would have a memory of an event or with an outcome. And, you know, the great Stan McChrystal will have made this decision or taken this action, and this would be the result. And I would either be very successful with it or not. And when we pulled all this together, we found that I may have made a big decision, but there were 1,000 other things that happened by countless other people behind the scenes, below the waterline, that were going on, and other contextual factors, so that my role in it was often much less than I'd imagined it. I wasn't even the star of my own life. I was a player. And I started to understand that's the reality of history. But the nature of how we record history and how we do biographies wants to make the leader the central player and the reason things happen or don't. And I've come to the conclusion that's just wrong.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, General Stanley McChrystal. We'll be right back after this.
This episode is sponsored in part by FreshBooks. If you run your own business, I bet you love being your own boss. I certainly know I do. endless earning potential, doing what you love every day certainly makes all the admin and paperwork worthwhile. So what if I told you there's an easier way to deal with all the time-consuming tasks, like the admin stuff, the paperwork? Our friends at FreshBooks make accounting software that's incredibly simple to use, which, as you might guess, makes accounting much easier and paperwork a thing of the past. When I say FreshBooks is easy to use, here's what I mean. You can create and send ultra-professional-looking invoices in about 30 seconds. Clients pay you directly through invoices with online payments, which in turn gets you paid twice as fast. You can also link your FreshBooks account to your credit and debit cards, so next time you expense a business lunch, it'll automatically show up in your FreshBooks account. As a FreshBooks customer for the last, 10-plus years, I've experienced firsthand how all the features can save a ton of time every week, which means I've got a lot more time to work on content for upcoming shows here.
Right now, we're giving our listeners a free 30-day trial of FreshBooks. No credit card needed. Just go to FreshBooks.com/Jordan and enter Jordan in the How Did You Hear About Us section. That's FreshBooks.com/Jordan and enter Jordan in the How Did You Hear About Us section.
This episode is sponsored in part by HostGator. Listen, we talk a lot about effective networking and relationship building on the show. Anyone who's been listening for a while understands the basics of connecting with and being of value to people who help us become better at who we are and what we do. But it's hard to get traction when your new connections look for you online and they see you don't even have a website. I'll admit, I'm a little judgy with that myself. And, you know, worse, maybe the only mention of you online is from some troll who's got a bone to pick with you or with your business. Why should that troll have control over your reputation when HostGator can have your website up and running today with you in the driver's seat? No experience with code necessary. If you can use a web browser, you can build your own website. No fuss, no muss. That's why we recommend HostGator's website builder. HostGator has 100-plus mobile-friendly templates, so it's going to look good on a tablet, phone, computer. You want WordPress? One click. Add-ons, couple clicks, like PayPal, so people can buy directly from your website. SEO plugins to help you show up higher in search, and 99.9% uptime, great tech support 24/7, 365, and it's not going to break the bank. HostGator's giving our wonderful listeners up to 62% off all packages for new users with a 45-day complete money-back guarantee. And you get unlimited email addresses based from your website. Most places don't offer that, so you end up getting upsold because you want to have one for yourself and one for your assistant, etc. Go to HostGator.com/Jordan right now to sign up. That's HostGator.com/Jordan. And thanks for supporting our sponsors that support the show.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. To learn more about our sponsors and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit JordanHarbinger.com/advertisers. And if you'd be so kind, please drop us a nice rating and review in iTunes or your podcast player of choice. It really helps us out and helps build the show family. If you want some tips on how to do that, head on over to JordanHarbinger.com/subscribe. And now back to our show with General Stanley McChrystal.
How come certain leaders take on certain leadership styles? Do you think this is just something that they're taught? Do you think it's in their DNA somewhere? Because I know, for example, yourself, you were is troublemaker the right word at West Point? You were kind of like, I don't want to say class clown. It might even be more serious than that. But I know you sort of thumbed your nose at authority. And then it's like, .. fast forward, he's commanding special forces, which is kind of what those guys are known for doing as well.
You know, it's funny. They used to joke, I'd thumb my nose at the man, and then I ended up being the man. Ironic is that? Yeah, I didn't always thumb it successfully, but I went through that part of my life. And I think that people take up leadership styles for lots of reasons. I think if we look at great leaders or leaders that we think were successful and we try to emulate them, it's always a bad idea. My father told me, he was a soldier for his whole career, and he said that after World War II, there were a whole group of officers who tried to be little George Pattons, and they'd be profane and sort of loud and whatnot. But nobody could be Patton but Patton. And I've seen in my life a lot of leaders who try to see something that works or a technique that becomes popular, and they try to copy that, and it's usually ineffective. I think that you can learn techniques from good leaders that you're around, and you can also learn things not to do from bad leaders, but too much of leaders has to be based on who you are, and even more of leadership has to be built on who your followers are and what the context in which you're leading. Because a Vince Lombardi style of leadership, if you if you narrow it down to saying, here's a hard driving, very disciplined guy, isn't going to work the same way in different contexts. So I think that the key thing for leaders is to understand there's not a leadership style that is right and the others are wrong. Every leadership style needs to be based on this very empathetic connection to your followers, so you understand what it is inspires or drives them, and this understanding that the environment around you is not only going to be complex and you'll have to deal with that, but it's constantly changing. So what you do on any given day, any given instance, has to be based on all of those factors. So you can't just pull out play number three and keep running it.
Yeah, that element of being a little bit of a rogue, or at least a flexible swim upstream type in a lot of ways. A lot of folks, in fact, I think I found this, I don't want to misquote this. I want to say this is from like Newsweek or something like that. But they said, McChrystal is a snake eating rebel, a Jedi commander. He didn't care when his teenage son came home with blue hair and a mohawk. He speaks his mind with candor, rare for a high-ranking official. He asks for opinions and seems genuinely interested in the response. He gets briefings on his iPod, to put a little timestamp on this, and listens to books on tape. He carries a custom-made set of nunchucks in his convoy, engraved with his name and four stars, and his itinerary often bears a fresh quote from Bruce Lee. And it goes on to say that you went out on dozens of nighttime raids during your time in Iraq, which is unusual. I mean, why would you go out on a raid and you turned up on missions unannounced with very little entourage? And this English SAS guy, I guess, he's a British officer who's serving Kabul. He said, you'd be out somewhere, Iraq, and I assume he's doing it with a British accent, so I won't try that. But he said, you'd be out somewhere in Iraq, someone would take a knee beside you, and a corporal would be like, who the hell is that? And it's fucking Stan McChrystal, is what he said.
No, most of what is in that article is true, although it's hyped up a little bit, clearly. You know, I was rebellious in the sense that if I thought things were stupid, then I just thought they were stupid and I wasn't interested in doing those. I also realized at some point in my career that almost all the right answers were in my organization well below me. And so it wasn't a case of people should be looking up and waiting for me to come up with the right answer. The thing was for me to help create an environment where the right answer could come out. And then what I could do is I could be an advocate for that. And that takes a little bit of coming to grips with your own ego, which, you know, I did over time. I think that it's really important for leaders to approach everything with a level of genuine humility. And yet that runs counter to some of what the environment around us wants. If you look at our politics today, a person's got to go out and say how good they are and everything they've done. Even if they're a naturally modest person, the environment is that you've got to beat your chest and sell your wares. But in reality, your wares might be much more humble than that. You might have created an environment in which an organization did very well. That's no less impressive than if you stood at the front of it and let everybody, you know, to the ramparts. But it doesn't sell as well. It's not as sexy. So the fact that I went out on raids with the force and all like that can sometimes be misunderstood that I'm going to go out and shoot the bad guys. That's not why I went out. I went out because I had to see what the force was doing. I had to understand what they were doing. And they had to understand that I cared. They had to understand that I was willing to accept some part of the risk and hardship with them. Not all that they did, but they had to understand that I was willing to do that so that I could, you know, communicate with them.
Right. That makes sense. Because I think a lot of people will take an anecdote like that and they'll suck that out of a story and they'll go, okay, so you have to be this rogue who goes out rifle in hand, you know, with a knife in your mouth or something, if you're going to be a good leader on the battlefield. Or you could just as easily say the key to running a good tech company is to be a big jerk face to everybody like Steve Jobs was and treat people poorly. And that's how you get results, because Apple, right? And these are dangerous assumptions for us to make about leaders. And in the book, you discuss these tensions. There's sort of three myths, actually, about leadership. And going along the lines of, we tend to put these leaders up on a pedestal and say, okay, the way that this person has achieved is excellent, so we have to emulate each element of their life or their behavior in order to get a similar result. And that stuff just isn't true. Can you drive us through these three myths? You've got the formulaic myth, the attribution myth, and the results myth. I think these are really applicable and interesting to today's leaders or just people that work with leaders, which I think is probably everyone.
Well, absolutely, Jordan. Thanks. We didn't know these myths when we started this book. And this was an interesting process because we didn't have a hard thesis. We let our study and the profiles pull us where they did. And what we came to fairly early in the process was the confirmation that leadership isn't something we truly understand. And as we looked at it, we come to the conclusion we've never understood it. It's not just a problem now. And so as a consequence, as we looked at this, we came with the three myths. The first, the formulaic, says that if we can get the traits, if we're born with the right traits, or if we can develop the right behaviors, we're going to be an effective leader. If Robert E. Lee did all these following things, or if Steve Jobs did, or you name it, and we embody those, that we'll be successful. And people have sold a lot of management books and leadership books on this with a list of things you can do. And the reality is we found no cases where a set of attributes or qualities that work for someone were transferable. There are things that work in others, but every situation is so unique. Every time is so unique. And so even for the same leader to be a leader on Monday in a certain way and then try to use exactly the same techniques the next day often is a loser. You know, you say, well, then you'd have no consistency. No, the reality is your consistency is your ability to adapt to the situation of the moment. In our study, the leader who comes out as the most adaptable, interestingly enough, is Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. He constantly adapts how we respond to situations and requirements in doing that. The second myth, the attribution myth, is really reinforced by things like biographies, because it says that an individual was the man of their times. Churchill shaped the outcome of World War II, or Abraham Lincoln won the Civil War, or you name it. And as we studied that, what we found was that's always a gross oversimplification. They may have had a significant role in it. But as we look through the lens of history, we tend to sharpen that focus so that we're only sharpening it on that person, sort of like putting the spotlight on them. And so when all we're seeing is the actions of that person, we tend to not be as aware of all the other things happening. And so the danger of the attribution myth is we start to think all we got to do is get a good leader and the problem is solved. And the reality is that's not true. It's actually the organization, the followers, the context of the situation that matters so much. As we studied this, we also found that a leader who does something in one place and is moved to another place and tries to repeat it almost never succeeds. And so as a consequence, we find that it's very contextual into what the leader does, and that is reinforced. The last myth is the results myth, and that is the idea that we are clear-eyed, calculating people. And so we follow or select or elect the leader who will most give us what we want. It will make the most money in the company, win the most victories on the battlefield, accomplish the most politically. And the reality is that's not true either. In reality, what we find is the actual performance and outcomes, measurable outcomes by many leaders, is got nothing to do with how successful they are in terms of being selected, elected, promoted, that sort of thing. There's something that our connection to leaders is more human. It's more organic. We want certain things from a leader that they provide, and it's not that strict outcome, bottom line results. We're willing to tolerate some pretty negative or disappointing results from leaders if they fill some other need in us. And it'll be interesting as we get in the age of big data and artificial intelligence, as we can amass more data on people's, the outcomes associated with someone's performance. And it'll be interesting to see whether we really use that in our people selection processes, or whether we'll let the human side of us continue to guide us.
You're listening to The Jordan Harbinger Show with our guest, General Stanley McChrystal. We'll be right back after these brief messages.
This episode is also sponsored by Purple. I'm in Australia right now, and I got to tell you that jet lag is kind of bugging me a little bit, and I miss being at home on my Purple mattress. If you have pain or stress that keeps you up at night, if you're feeling like you get trouble going to sleep because you got all this stuff on your mind, Purple might be a good thing for you to look into here. If you're struggling for any reason to get a good night's sleep, try a Purple mattress. The founders of Purple are two brothers who have been developing cushioning technology for 30 years in things like medical beds and wheelchairs. Feels really different. The materials have actually been developed by a real rocket scientist. It's not like memory foam. I know that's what you're thinking. It's not that. It's different. The Purple material feels very unique because it's both firm and soft at the same time. So it keeps everything supported while still feeling really comfortable. Plus, it's breathable, so it sleeps cool. 100-night free trial. If you're not fully satisfied, return the mattress for a full refund, backed by a 10-year warranty, free shipping and returns. And they'll even get rid of your old mattress, your old crappy bug-filled, skin-filled mattress. How's that for a visual?
You're gonna love Purple. And right now, our listeners will get a free Purple pillow with the purchase of a mattress. That's in addition to the great free gifts they offer site-wide. Just text Jordan, that's J-O-R-D-A-N, to 474747. The only way to get this free pillow is to text Jordan to 474747. One more time, Jordan to 474747.
This episode is sponsored in part by Omigo Bidet. Jason didn't want to take part in this ad because he's like, I don't want water squirted on my bum. And yet, now I know what you're thinking. Wait, is this really an ad for a bidet? Is it April 1st? Is this some kind of joke? No, it's not. Omigo is, first of all, they get that it's kind of weird to shoot water at your butt after you go to the bathroom. So the packaging is fun. The marketing is really fun. I will admit, I've got bidets on every toilet in my house except for one, because I know that the one that's in the guest area, people are like, nah, they're never going to use it.
That's the one that I go to when I stay at your house.
That's Jason's toilet. Look, this, first of all, you laugh, but you can adjust the water temperature, the position, the pressure, the width, the movement. It feels like you just took a shower instead of just like you smeared peanut butter on your arm. I won't go into more detail than that. It's got a heated seat. Ladies and dudes, for that matter, you sit on a seat and you're like, oh, okay, this is an uncomfortability of life. No more. It's actually warmer than the rest of the house. There's a nightlight. It's soft, opens and closes. It will dry. It's got a dryer built in. It'll dry your bum. That's right. And it's remote controlled. So you don't have to reach around the seat trying to feel around for buttons. There's a remote you put next to it. I'm telling you, there's a deodorizer. It's a carbon filter. It eliminates odors. No more TP. You're saving trees. You're saving water. You're saving electricity. The U.S. alone uses like 36 million rolls of toilet paper in one day. I'm not making that up. 36 million rolls of toilet paper in one day. It's cleaner. It's safe. Don't worry about, you know, sanitation. I know what you're thinking. Ew. I'm telling you, try this. It's quick and easy. You can install it in 20 minutes. Get $100 off your order when you go to myomigo.com/Jordan. That's myomigo, O-M-I-G-O, myomigo.com/Jordan. $100 off. The future seems weird at first. Just let it be weird.
Thanks for listening and supporting the show. Your support of our advertisers is what keeps us on the air. And to learn more and get links to all the great discounts you just heard, visit jordanharbinger.com/advertisers. And now for the conclusion of our show with General Stanley McChrystal.
I wonder if there's a point at which you foresee leaders saying, well, the computer says we have to do all of the big AI box in the corner says this is our battle plan. And we're just going to follow this, even though my gut says otherwise. The computer always knows best. I mean, that has to at some point be very likely. Would you expect that?
I think I would. I tell a story often. The military has a planning process called the military decision-making process. And it's a series of steps you go through from getting a mission and then gathering facts, developing courses of action, and then measuring or comparing those courses of action. And it produces a numerical outcome. And an organization, a unit in the military, will have a staff, and they will go through that staff process, and it will produce a numeric outcome. Typically, they'll look at three courses of action, and they'll be each graded. And the commander will often come in and select the best one with the highest score. The problem is the outcome of that entire process can be changed just by adjusting the weighting of the criteria, how you weight the things you measure. And so if a commander comes in and automatically accepts that, it's a cop-out. What they're doing is they're hiding behind the process. If things go badly, they can then go, hey, look, we did this big process. We got this number. I followed my staff's recommendation. But that's not why we hire commanders. The process has value in that it fleshes out the problem. It uncovers issues. But we expect the commander to put the human part of that in there, to understand the nuances and the limitations of a process like that. I think you're going to find a lot of leaders in the near future that literally stand behind artificial intelligence and say, as you described, yeah, this is what the box says, so I can't be fired or held culpable if it all goes badly. But yes, they can. In my view, because they can be informed by the artificial intelligence process, they can be aided, they can do all those things. But at the end of the day, we expect judgment, experience, all of those things to be layered on top of that. And I think that will be one of the differences between truly effective leaders in the future in that environment and the rest.
It's super interesting because I can totally see there almost being a tension between human leadership and computer leadership. I mean, there probably is already, for all I know. I really don't even know. There's probably a whole bunch of data tools and analytics that you have to use in making decisions. And I mean, does that exist? Does that happen at the high levels of military? Do you get things like, well, the satellite shows this, but you know, I feel like this is a bad idea. I mean, satellites are photos, so at least you're looking at something, but do you have artificial intelligence making predictions and probabilities and things like that? Or is it still kind of a manual human process?
It's still pretty manual in the military for that kind of thing. And I think it will be helpful to have more data, but you're going to have leaders who are particularly educated in how to live in that environment. So that right now, I think we're still with generations that aren't yet ready to do that. Now, there are places in the military where artificial intelligence on very fast responding things like anti-missile weapon systems. They see an incoming missile and there's almost no time for humans to contribute to the process. So there's going to be artificial intelligence driving that. And we pretend that we'll never do anything without a human in the loop, but we will. We'll have to because the response times will be too low. But those are more reflexive. You can set up the algorithms for those to do certain things. For the longer term decisions, as you're discussing, we're not yet at a point in the military. And in my work in the civilian world, although there's tremendous amount of data in some industries, I don't yet see many to the point where they are able even to do that. But I think we're pretty close.
Going back to the three myths, formulaic myth, attribution myth, and the results myth, when we're examining leaders, instead of asking how did they lead, which is, like you said, where we find ourselves when we're reading biographies and things like that, what other questions were you asking? I know one of them, which you had mentioned, was what was it about the situation that made this style of leadership effective? And I think that's a distinctly different question.
It absolutely is. And, you know, if you start on a study like this, we thought we'd be comparing leaders to say, how did this one lead differently than that one? And,
right.
And it wasn't that much to that to be because the situations were always so different. Instead, the real question came is, why did this person emerge as a leader? And if they were effective in that environment, why? What were the things that drove that? Or if they were ineffective, what were the things that drove that? And what we typically found was there was an intersection between an individual being available, an individual being having certain qualities, literally colliding with a situation. And that caused this emergence. But then even then, it wasn't quite that clear. It wasn't, they didn't pull the sword out of the stone and become King Arthur. Instead, it was a case of they started to emerge, and it was either reinforced or not by the interaction with the followers in the situation. Martin Luther, for example, in the Protestant Reformation, this wasn't a rogue monk who nails 95 theses on the church door and starts something. He came along at exactly a moment when there was unhappiness with the organized church, organized religion in Germany and in Western Europe. He started saying things that some other people were already saying, and he became both a symbol of it and a leader of a movement. But it only happened because all of those other factors intersected at the same time. And that proves true in almost every instance.
What other questions do we ask when we're examining leaders? Yes, of course, what about the situation made the style of leadership effective? What other questions do we ask that are more useful in examining certain types of behavior or certain types of characteristics that we can then emulate?
Well, I think the basic question people often ask is that person a good leader or a bad leader? And of course, pretty quickly, we came to the conclusion, good and bad in terms of whether they are virtuous or not is kind of irrelevant. That doesn't really affect a person's effectiveness as a leader. If they are effective as a leader, then you look at, okay, why did they emerge? And what are those things about them that allowed them to be that? It comes down to, at some point, are these God-given traits? Is that person born a certain way? And we couldn't prove or disprove that. We couldn't say that, you know, the person's gifts weren't part of it. But yet you can certainly question it, because if you look at Harriet Tubman, you know, a 5 foot tall African-American slave, no education, and she arises to become a leader, and she's got none of the overt leadership traits or qualities that we expect. Or we talk about charisma being important. We look at Maximilien de Robespierre, the French Revolution. He actually was an introvert who stayed in his room most of the time, wrote his speeches, often didn't deliver them in person. And so as a consequence, it was his ideas and his sort of unwavering conviction that did it. And so when people say, well, how do we go find the right leaders? Who do we look for? People with straight teeth and good posture and those kinds of things. And the answer is, it's not even that simple. We've got to look at that intersection between opportunity, commitment on the part of the person, willingness to adapt to the situation that they find themselves in and keep adjusting so that they're not leaders for just an instant, but in stack, it applies over time. And all of that's extraordinarily complicated process.
Now, looking back at these individual traits of leaders, it is very difficult, or I should say, actually, it's very easy to pick out one or two little anecdotes. And you touched on this earlier with the whole, like, oh, well, McChrystal goes out on the raids and things like that. It's easy to pick sort of one anecdote and say, this is the type of thing that I need to be doing. And I was doing research on you for this interview, and I noticed that there's a couple of mentions of you eating like one meal a day or something like that. And I wondered, is that something that a lot of people are taking out of that, of these interviews or of this media appearance that you did? And they're going, that's a life hack, one meal a day. Whereas I'm wondering, from your perspective, are you just thinking, look, I was really busy running a war in Afghanistan. I only had time for one meal a day. And we kind of, as outsiders, look at this perspective and think that that's something that we then need to emulate in order to get the same results.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right, Jordan. You know, I think of Forrest Gump running down the road and all these people running after him. He doesn't know why he's running. They don't know why they're following him. I get asked more often about why one meal a day and why I slept 4 hours a night than anything else. And it's interesting. I started eating one meal a day about 40 years ago as a lieutenant when I thought I was getting fat. And so I just developed the habit. There's no zen to it. It works for me. I'm 64 years old right now. I'm in great health. So why would I change? I slept 4 hours a night because that's how much time I had. We were very, very busy and I felt I had to lean into it. And that would be wrong for anyone else. I've actually had people contact me and say, how can I become more like you? And I said, God save yourself. Don't do that. Figure out what is needed in the situation you're in. And what about you could make better to do that? And that's why the 7 habits of highly effective people and I'm not down on any single effort, but it's very dangerous to try to reduce these things to a few habits or behaviors or traits.
Right. It's human nature. There's something in human nature that says, I want this to be simple and have 3 techniques to being a more powerful leader today instead of finding out what meshes with our personality, with our team, with the circumstances, with the context of the situation, with our industry, because that's much more complicated and requires a lot more thinking and a lot more work, right?
That's exactly it. It's just, we want to be given an answer we can digest very quickly. And so, boom, follow it. And it's like a diet book. The reality is we know a lot about what makes people gain and lose weight. And it's their personal behavior, but it's pretty individual. And so to read a book and say, well, I'll only eat, you know, horse meat on Tuesdays and that'll solve my problem is ridiculous. We can learn more about body's work, but we also have to learn about us, what we can do, what we're good at, what our followers want.
Originally, I thought this was a question that I would only ask somebody who is in a highly politically charged position. But now that I think about it, there's so many people in corporations or even in entrepreneur or family businesses that have political-ish situations around them, not politics in general, but where they have to worry about other types of influence. And I was wondering, your time overseas running a war, I mean, how do you stay focused on what's important when there are so many distractions and so many other people trying to influence your actions? You know, I thought this question would only apply to somebody in your position, but the more I think about it, the more I realize if you're in a corporation, you've got shareholders, you've got employees. If you're in a family business, you got to worry about what your grandpa thinks, right? or whatever, right, when you're running a business. And how do you stay focused on what's important when there's all these external influences or attempted influences?
That's a great point. One of the first things I had to learn to understand, and I didn't know it right up front, but all of those things are relevant. You try to say, well, I've got to ignore the politics and fight the war. Well, at the 4-star level, fighting the war is the politics. You've got plenty of people junior to you that know how to move forces, know how to do all the things that are tactical execution of warfare. But at the senior level, if you don't get the politics right, there's no chance to win. And so the first thing you have to do is understand that is part of what you do. And the second is to understand that there are all these different competing interests. In Afghanistan, my coalition was 46 nations. And those 46 nations largely had come to Afghanistan because the United States had asked them to. All of them had a different background politically, different situation. They deployed forces to this theater of war with different hopes for it. And in many cases, all they wanted to do was be a good partner for the U.S. But as a consequence, we had junior commanders from some of these countries on the ground with maybe a battalion or even less of troops talking to their prime minister periodically or their head of the military. That's like, you know, the president of the United States calling down to a sergeant somewhere or equivalent and telling them what they want. Think of the pressure that person's under and being told, don't do this with our forces because politically, domestically, that'll be an issue. So the politics aren't a distraction. They are part of the reality. And if you understand that and don't resent it, don't automatically say, well, all politics are bad. No, politics are people and their interests. And it, you know, that's why wars are fought. I had to learn, how do I deal with that? How do I mesh the two together? And what I tried to do was give the people below me who are out doing things enough of the political context so they understand the environment they're operating in. They understand what's important, what isn't, so that we're not tone deaf, but then also not have them subject to too much political pressure, because that's sort of the job that I had. I'm supposed to take that pressure and only pass the relevant, important things down so the people below me, relatively unencumbered, can do their job. Never, you know, you can never stop it completely. And that, I think, is the job of leaders at many levels, where that's what they are supposed to do. I think there is this myth that says that generals can be apolitical and they can just say, I'm a technician. Tell me when you want the war to start. I'll start the war. I'll fight the war. And when it's over, I'll give you the situation and you politicians can take it from there. That's absurd, because war is an extension of politics, as Clausewitz taught us, and he's absolutely right. And everything you do at a strategic level in the military has to be based on the political reality. How much support do you have for what you're trying to do? How much do you need to give up, compromise, interact? All of those things are things that I think mature military leaders need to do. Now, that doesn't mean you need to be a partisan political mind. You're not a Democratic or Republican general. If you are, shame on you. But you need to be, they are part of the context of the environment in which you operate. And to be dismissive of that is, you know, an absolute mistake.
I know that you retired in 2010, and unfortunately, you're relieved of your position as the top commander in Afghanistan by President Obama. And it was because of this controversial interview that you'd done with Rolling Stone magazine. It was, at the time, Obama said, what you'd said in the article does not meet the standards that should be set by a commanding general. And that, when I read that, I was shocked. And so I have a kind of a dumb question here, which first, how did that feel? Because I know from starting my own show over earlier this year that being removed or removing yourself or leaving a position like that, it's not just put your badge and gun on the table type of situation like you'd see in a movie. There's your identity can kind of fly away with it as well if you're not careful.
Yeah, and I'll start by giving the background. An article came out in Rolling Stone, and it quoted, my team is saying things that were viewed as incorrect politically and whatnot. And I didn't think the article was an accurate portrayal of the team, but that's irrelevant. I'm responsible. A reporter writes an article about my team, and it ends up on the desk of the president, who is my commander in chief. And so I've passed a problem or caused a problem for him, and I shouldn't do that. And so I offered my resignation, and he accepted it, and I completely understood and bore him no ill will for that. Now, I was crushed by the experience. In my life, I never thought that I would be accused of being off the rails or disloyal or anything like that. And I can assure you, I never was. But it doesn't matter whether you were or not. My name was on the ticker of the news every 30 seconds for, you know, my moment of fame or notoriety, sure. Which went, it doesn't last as long as you think it does. In your own mind, it lasts a long time. It actually lasts just several days. But my 86-year-old father was watching it. My son, off in college, was watching it. My wife was watching it. And so I felt like I'd let my family down, and also felt like I'd let everybody who served with me down and had believed with me for so long. And so you go through that period where you've lost your identity as a soldier. You also believe that you've lost your identity or your credibility with many people as a figure and as a friend and all of these things. So it's a moment in which I think probably many other people have gone through this, go through incredible doubts. And you start to wonder about where you fit in the world, what your future is going to be. Will you ever get your respect and your self-respect back? What I learned was, yes, you will, if you decide to. I made the decision, and really, I think my wife is the one who helped me make this, because she absolutely said, I've related this in my memoirs, I came home from resigning and my career is literally over in the blink of an eye after 34 years as an officer. And I told her, and she'd grown up in the military and been with me all those years. And she said, good, we've always been happy and we always will be happy. And she's so focused us on the future and not the past. And she's been that way her whole life. I joke with her that she lives life like she drives, with no use for the rearview mirror. But she said, there's no point in trying to relitigate what has happened. Let's move forward. Let's define our lives in the future by what we want to be, and then let people judge us. And it has been the best thing that could have happened, because I focused entirely forward. I mean, there are days when it still hurts to think about that. But the reality is, starting with my wife and then with this group of friends, many of whom I hadn't seen for years, they came out like a safety net, and they catch you and then they wrap you up. And if you allow them to give you strength back and sort of get your confidence back, then suddenly you can, everything can go back in perspective. And I've told a lot of people since then that if they have one of these points in their life when everything seems suddenly the bottom to have fallen out, that they are the person who decides how it goes from there. If they want to wallow in it, you can. You can be bitter, but nobody cares if you're bitter. It doesn't make anyone else happy to see you bitter. It's actually better to decide you're going to be happy and decide you're going to try to keep making a contribution. And that, to me, turned out to be the best decision I've ever made.
I think your wife's reaction was priceless. I can imagine you walk in, you know, head held a little bit lower than usual, and you see, and you tell her it's over, and she says, good. And she probably wants to go on vacation without, like, an entourage of 11 people and email and phone calls coming in every 5 minutes.
I think you're right, Jordan. I think she did. But I also think she knew me so well that she knew at that moment that her reaction would mean more to me than probably anything else in life. At that moment, she probably held my self-esteem in her hand, because she was the person I was coming back to report to of my failure. And I think she did it intuitively, but I think that it was, you know, in retrospect, brilliant.
I feel like we should end on a high note. I love that. I love that final thought, though. But I feel like it might be better to end on a high note. I'm feeling that pressure.
I think life is a high note. I think the interesting thing about leadership is you make a decision to try to be a leader. You choose that, or you can back away from it. And some people get put in situations, but where people are put in a case where they can lead and they step up and do it, it's kind of extraordinary to see the positive impact that they can have. I mean, I go back to Martin Luther King Jr. He's a 26-year-old preacher in a new church that he's just joined in Montgomery, Alabama, and he takes over the Montgomery Improvement Association's boycott of buses against segregated public transportation. He lives 13 more years, and for the next 13 years, he's jailed 12 times. He pulls together this diverse group of organizations, all of which trying to take a different route toward better civil rights in America. He fights against incredible amounts of resistance, but he does it with humility. He does it with class. He does it with courage. He does it with persistence. When we see that, and we see that kind of person, he wasn't perfect. And in fact, it would ruin him as an image if he had been perfect. It reminds me what leaders can do if they're willing to.
General, thank you so much. This was an excellent, excellent interview. And the book, Leaders, Myth, and Reality, if you're into history, you'll like it. If you're into leadership topics, you'll also like it. So I think it's a... When I saw this book from you, I was a little bit surprised. I thought, oh my gosh, this guy is a glutton for punishment, because this, you can just see the amount of work that went into this. Your team must be a bunch of all-stars.
They really were. We had the three main authors and then three brilliant young people who worked literally full-time for 15 months. We had a call, a video call every Sunday morning at 6 o'clock for 15 months, because that was the one time we could find everybody available. And we would just beat through issues. It was an extraordinary experience to work with people who were just passionate to create something of value.
What's next for you? Are you kind of done writing books? I know you have your the McChrystal Group and things like that. Do you have any other interesting projects in the works?
Well, you know, there's always something going. And so McChrystal Group has grown to 100 people. So that's become really exciting. But with every book, as soon as I finish it, I spike the football in the end zone and I say never again. But truth is, I just had a conversation with a publisher and he likes a new idea. And so I'm scared that I'm going to say yes.
Well, when you do, or if you do, we'll see you back on the show at that time, I think. So thank you once again for coming on. Really, really interesting. It's always good to talk to you.
Jordan, it's my honor. Thanks so much for your time.
All right, Jason, another good conversation with General McChrystal. He is always so open. For somebody, you know, you kind of don't expect it, right?
Yeah, and he's funny as can be. When we were bantering before the show, he was just throwing out one-liners hand over fist, something you never would expect.
Yeah, you kind of don't expect that. You don't really see that coming from somebody who is, like, in such serious situations and control of so many people's lives and at the highest ranks of the military. It's kind of nice that there's humans up there, right? It's kind of nice to see.
Definitely. You want the guys with the guns to at least have some kind of sense of humor.
That's right. That's right. The book title is Leaders, Myth and Reality. And a big thank you to General McChrystal for coming out today. If you want to know how I meet all these amazing folks, you want to know why I almost ignored a phone call from General McChrystal, it's because I have so much opportunity coming as a result of my relationships, of my network that I built over time. That's the only way to build a network, is you have to start before you need that network. I use systems and I use tiny habits, and it's a lot of fun. It's a few minutes per day, and I want to teach you how I do it for free. So go to advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. And don't go, yeah, I'll do that later. The problem with that, you can't kick the can down the road and expect the results to be the same. As we always say here, you have to dig the well before you're thirsty. And these drills are designed to just be real quick every day. Instead of maybe a few minutes in line with Instagram, spend it with these drills. I wish I knew this stuff a decade ago. It would have made a huge difference. And you can find all of that at advancedhumandynamics.com/level1. Speaking of building relationships, tell me your number one takeaway here from the General. I'm at Jordan Harbinger on both Twitter and Instagram. And don't forget, if you want to learn how to apply everything you heard today from General McChrystal, make sure you go grab the worksheets, also in the show notes, at jordanharbinger.com/podcast. This show is produced in association with Podcast One, and this episode was co-produced by Jason the Colonel DeFilippo and Jen Harbinger. Show notes are by Robert Fogarty. Special thanks to Jimmy for helping prep for this episode. That was a huge help, buddy. Thank you very much. Worksheets by Caleb Bacon, and I'm your host, Jordan Harbinger. The fee for this show is that you share it with friends when you find something useful, which is hopefully in every episode. So please share the show with those you love and even those you don't. Lots more in the pipeline. Very excited to get it out to you. And in the meantime, do your best to apply what you hear on the show so you can live what you listen. And we'll see you next time.